You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Carl Frederick. Carl, it's good to have you here this morning.
Thank you much. Very good to be here.
So Carl, the way we start the show is with a big question. Who are you? What do we need to know about what you aspire to be, who you've been, where the labels you've worn, okay. The things you've done? What do we need to know to start this conversation?
Well, that's already a refinement. I would have started with what am I,
but we'll start. Go ahead and start.
No,
with
who will be good? Who will be good?
You would be the first person to answer, what am I?
Okay, well, we'll try with that. I sort of think of myself as an instantiation, that's a bad word, incorporation of curiosity. I'm a very curious individual, and people might say nosy, but I'll say curious.
Right, and you use the word instantiation, which means the instance it all comes together.
Yes. Yeah. And but I identify as a... with my passion, which is theoretical physics, and that is something so unworldly. It's almost a priesthood, being a physicist. The universe tells us is the game, and we're trying to understand the game, trying to figure out the rules, and the universe is. Plays by some very complicated and very, very strange rules.
Right, and maybe even rules might not be the right word.
It's interesting you should say that. I'm, I guess, a follower of Korzybski. Do you know the name Alfred Korzybski? There's a branch of logical positivism called general semantics. It's a terrible, terrible word, general semantics, because it gives the wrong impression. Alfred Korzybski... you may never have heard of general semantics, but I bet you know the main mantra of general semantics, which is the map is not the territory.
Right.
And the idea here is that we use words to describe the world, but the map, the words, are a poor map.
Right, right.
And so he believed that most of the problems, if not all of the world, are due to misuse of language, to not having the right language, and at the minimum, not using it well.
Right, and not understanding the difference between the map and the world.
That indeed is a very, very big problem. And it's a big problem in physics, because we don't really have language to describe what the world is doing.
Right.
But we try to use language, and it doesn't work.
So how has this shaped your life, this awareness? And your relationships.
My relationships to the world and my relationships.
To your life and your relationships. Yeah.
Well, my kids always knew when I was on a kick for either writing or physics. They knew enough not to try to bring me back into the real world. I don't know which world was real. For me, when I'm doing
the
other world is real.
They not try to connect with you in those moments.
Yeah. And sometimes those moments went on for a while.
Yeah.
So, physics for me is very important. And as a break for physics, I guess I'm called a professional short story writer, a successful professional short story writer. But that's an oxymoron. There's no such thing as a successful short story writer. Nobody reads it. I'm a science fiction writer. So,
So you're saying that you're published, but you don't make a living on it, and people don't read it, or you do make a living?
I don't make a living on it, and I'm considered a writer that people read a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The number one science fiction magazine in the country is Analog Magazine. And over the last, 10 years or so, I've had 45 stories there.
Wow.
So I have a following and a readership, but no one can make a living in short story writing.
Right.
There have been two. One is Harlan Ellison, but of course he does mainly TV work.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is a writer no one's ever heard of outside of the genre, Howard Waldrop, fine writer, and he only writes short stories. But he just ekes out a living, and it's too bad because he's a very fine writer.
Okay. Well, we're going to come back to some of these themes over the course of the hour.
Okay. Good.
You brought some music, and you wanted to start with a Bruckner piece. Do you want to introduce it?
Yes. This is the ending of the first movement of Bruckner's Third Symphony. Now, as strange as it sounds, when I do physics, I think of a particular piece of music, and this is it.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a piece of music that frankly grabs you by the neck and shakes. It's a Bruckner is very wild, and I love it.
So I'm like, this is like a full body contact sport.
Yes, very much. You'll hear it.
Here we go. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Carl Frederick. So that's the piece of music that you, one of the pieces, or the main piece of music you would use to do physics.
Strangely enough, I use a different piece when I'm doing physics in the car at night, but that's another story.
Okay, so when you talk, I mean, by doing physics, were you was your career in physics? Or
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And so,
I'm a quantum theorist, and quantum is so alien. It is. Well, Richard Feynman, my hero, said you could understand all of quantum mechanics just by understanding the two-slit experiment. But unfortunately, nobody understands the two-slit experiment, is what he said.
Yes.
And that is indeed the case. And so doing quantum mechanics is really thinking outside the box, because the box doesn't work.
Right. So what was the relationship of your work with your music? How did it create the context or the vehicle, or did it allow you to disengage from stuff so you could immerse yourself?
I'm not sure. When I do physics, I think in pictures. I'm very nonverbal when I'm doing physics.
Right.
And in fact, when I'm heavy in physics, sometimes it takes me a while to be able to speak again because I'm so nonverbal. And music is nonverbal. Mm-hmm. And so I think it just makes, for some reason, a closer connection with the way I think than words do.
Right. And I'm also thinking when you work with your muscles and your body, you're also thinking in nonverbal ways because your whole body is an instrument at that point.
Mm, interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way.
I'm a person that I am restored by physical labor. I have to physically labor, and music is good to accompany that. We used to sing conversation to each other in the poor rural white tradition that I grew up in, which is kind of an analog to the African American spirituals.
Interesting.
But it would be created dialogue.
Interesting.
And it touches those spaces that are verbal and nonverbal all at once.
Well, it's interesting. I worked till exhaustion 6 days a week on an elliptical trainer. And I listened to music during that time, and I probably speak Dutch because of it, because it's a Netherlands classical music station I'm listening to while I'm doing it. But so I can see that connection between physical and music. Interesting.
And we process things in many different ways,
we do
some
indeed.
Of which we're not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
So let me move away a bit from the physics now.
Okay.
We met at a I'm blocking on the name of the
Better Angels.
Better Angels event where you had come as a discussant.
Yes.
And tell me about your interest in Better Angels, the project, and why you chose to participate.
Well, I'm very much a left winger, I guess I should say. In Ithaca, that's probably middle of the road. But and the discord in the country now, the fact that we're not talking to each other. I loathe the current administration, but that doesn't mean I can't talk to other people about it. And Better Angels is an organization that tries to bring left and right together to talk, not to paper over differences, but to talk. And I think that's a noble end, a very noble end.
And how did you learn about the organization?
I saw a little clip out on a bulletin board, and so I phoned the person.
You're a good Ithacan. You read the bulletin boards.
Yeah, I read bulletin boards, absolutely.
Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And what, I guess, and from the point of view of this show, why, for you, more than some, or at least enough to get you out, do you really want this dialogue to happen? What about your life or your practice makes it kind of an important value for you?
Well, the old saying, it's better to light a candle than to rail against the darkness. And I thought the darkness is pretty dark.
Right.
And I felt I had to at least be part of that candle.
Mm-hmm.
Simple as that, really.
Right. So, and what in that day of conversation, what surprised you, if anything?
It did, actually. I think I mentioned it at the end of it, is that I'm so used to demonizing the other side in finding that the people on the other side aren't demons. And a couple of them I could think of as friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a surprise to me.
What about what they said or they communicated by whatever means humanized them for you?
Well, it's a lesson I learned a couple of times. One is when I was in secondary school, there was a wonderful kid, he's a friend, is South African, and he mm-hmm. believed 100% in apartheid. And of course, my political views were quite the other. And it took me a while to realize he could be a really good kid and still believe something that I thought was horrible.
Right. I mean, heinous or criminal.
Heinous, yeah, indeed. Yeah, yeah, indeed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's a lesson one could learn a number of times. And I learned it again at Better Angels.
Right. So were there specific things, though, about the people that struck you as their humanity kind of coming into contact with you that you hadn't, you know, you're open to talking with other people, but they become human around particular issues or particular ways of sighing or gestures or anecdotes that just catch the...
No, for me, it was that they spoke without shibboleth, without mantra. They were speaking as human beings, not as just repeating points of view or repeating...
They were thoughtful.
They were thoughtful. That's the word, yes. They were thoughtful. And I like that.
Right. No, and yeah, I mean, yeah. So for you to discover that they were not just generating canned positions, mm-hmm. but they were thoughtful people mm-hmm. who put them together in novel ways for themselves.
Yes.
And owned them so that they speak... Like, I mean, I'm speaking with my natural voice and you can, mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. can hear that. And when I'm trying to be something other than what I am, sometimes that shows.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. What would you hope would happen from the Better Angels dialogues? What would you hope would be a next step, if any?
I don't know, really. I like the idea that they are becoming more national mm-hmm. and that the whole idea of speaking to the other side, whatever that side is not anathema to people anymore, mm-hmm. or hopefully is not.
Right. Mm-hmm. My question is, I have been fostering conversations for a long, long time.
So I can.
And in some capacity since I was in junior high school, mm-hmm. because I tended to be the person who had relationships with all the different factions mm-hmm. of kids mm-hmm. in the school,
yes.
economic class and politics and values and whatever.
Hmm.
So that, you know, that's, so what I've discovered is oftentimes conversations have a value in and of themselves, and they don't end up in going to action. But people who are nimble at talking with each other may find that when an occasion arises, they can do something quickly together.
Yes, that's a good point. I have mentioned the day-long event mm-hmm. to friends and enthusiastically, but I must say that I haven't done anything terribly active after
right.
that.
And changing a culture involves more resetting our expectations, which I think is what you're doing.
Yes.
And that's very yes. slow, and it resets what people think about as possible more even than what they think about as strategic.
You know, it's funny, in physics, there's Max Planck, who's sort of the father of quantum mechanics, mm-hmm. made the statement that physics makes progress one funeral at a time, meaning that the old ideas have to die,
yes,
and
yes.
and the people that hold them have to die for that to happen, and that
right.
makes room for the new.
Right, and in a certain sense, in an age of extreme self-righteousness,
yes,
we have to die to our own values in order to figure out what is viable in the next iteration.
Well said.
Because we have come to loggerheads.
Yeah, very well said. I agree with you.
It's I wanted to go to the Better Angels conversation, but I really want to talk about, because this is the way you've framed your life, what is this relationship with physics that you have? How did it get started? How has it developed over the years? How has it changed? And has writing taken its place, or are you still a practicing physicist?
One never stops practicing physics.
Yeah. I had a feeling that was going to be your comeback.
I feel for kids these days that don't know what they want to do. I've known more or less what I've wanted to do since I was 9 or 10.
And how, what was that that you knew at 9 or 10?
Well, 9 or 10, it was science, and mainly through astronomy. I started out as an amateur astronomer, mm-hmm. and kids memorize well, so I knew the name of every star in the sky that had a name.
Right.
Then I did my postdoc, actually, at NASA, so I... It permeates one's life, science and physics.
Right. What do you remember at 8 or 9 was compelling? What was the passion or the attraction or the draw that pulled you to science?
The infinity of space, really. The sheer size of the universe compared to being a small 9-year-old in a very constrained life.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in 2 places. My early life was in Australia, actually, and then New York City was part of it also. And a single parent, and frankly, very poor family. We had very little. We were homeless for a while and sometimes didn't have food and things of this sort. So life as on the outside of one's own mind was a little rough. And I'm an only child, and only child children tend to often be very imaginative and have their own inner life. And I had a very strong inner life. in fact, I was switched in school from being left-handed to right-handed, and I was strongly left-handed, so the switch was very bad, and I could never write. And so I had to create my own alphabet, my own writing system mm-hmm. that was at that time all straight lines because I couldn't do anything else. And that isolated me even more from the rest of humanity. I still use that system.
Right.
I write everything in my system. It's evolved over a zillion years. But it's when you have your own writing system, you eventually have your own language, which I did.
Right.
You eventually have your own holidays, your own culture, your own... rituals and habits, and I did. A very imaginative kid.
A universe of experiences.
Yeah, it was a universe, yes. Yeah. One's own universe.
I share the experience of having tried to be, I'm strongly left-handed, though I have some coordination in my right hand, but they tried to switch me in first grade, and I spent an entire class day, as I remember it, trying to hold the pencil in my right hand the way they wanted me to, and making it sit in my left hand in exactly the same way.
Ah.
And that was my act of resistance.
And
I'm just enough younger than you that they didn't try to completely overwhelm me to force me to change.
Oh, I was forced. I like to say that I'm ambisinistrous. So I do things equally badly with both hands.
Ambisinistrous. So that is very good. I will remember that line. You also said something about the being a small boy, and
I was one, yes.
And having this notion of infinity.
Yes.
And for me, it was a little bit later, but it came at some point in late teen years that I realized that, you know, infinity is a really wonderful concept. And it's one of those kind of pure concepts that experientially we can neither verify or disconfirm, confirm or disconfirm. So it led to this whole line of thinking that fascinated me in my teens and 20s. How can we know whether something just exceeds what we know, or it exceeds it infinitely?
Yes, indeed.
And all of those, from part of my background is in religion, and many of the excessive theological claims regard a kind of infinity which is not supported by many texts.
Yes.
And so we start walking into worlds of projections and building rules and building things for our managing our social life that are built on assumptions that don't really work very well.
And that grew with me. I read science fiction at an early age, and still do, and still write it, of course. And that stretches one's thinking too.
How did you go from poverty, occasional homelessness, to how were you able in that somewhat uncertain, perhaps chaotic.
Very uncertain. Very chaotic.
Very chaotic. How were you able to anchor yourself with learning?
It's an interesting question. I don't drink and I don't smoke. And why? The reason is that I had nothing when I was growing up, except people said I was clever. And so I thought, I will never do anything that will hurt or possibly hurt my mind. And so for me, everything became mind-oriented, mental-oriented. And I guess partially because of my inability to write, I memorized everything. Wow. Everything. I have a really large reservoir of classical literature and all of these things just because it was necessary.
You wanted to hold it.
I wanted to hold it all. I'm in a language nut too, and learned a zillion languages, and just because I needed to have something. And that's what I had.
Right.
The only thing I had growing up was my mind, really.
Right. And you grew up with your mom?
Yes, I did.
And how did that? Because this is when you grow up in that kind of poverty and chaos, that bond is often one of the tightest things. How did that change as you went on to college or as you progressed through high school?
You know, it's really hard to say. It's very hard to say. I'm not sure that I was a whole individual at that point. I was so oriented on thought that the outside world sometimes really did not have much of a hold for me. And maybe
physical or emotional existence didn't have much of reality because
I had a very shallow and very, very tight emotional state. I hid my emotions. I still do, actually.
Right.
But I hid them because they were bad. And so when you hide your emotions, what else do you have? And you have the rational. So I really stressed what I thought was the rational.
Right, right. And was it your mind, because you were clever, was something you wanted to protect?
Yes.
And so no drugs, no alcohol.
No drugs, no alcohol, no whatever.
But it also becomes your ticket out.
Yes, it was.
And when it becomes your ticket out, you become a slave to its master.
That's correct. I believe that to be true.
And
I'm a willing slave,
right,
by the way.
And I too lived it. So when I got out from the poverty and the violence of my particular upbringing.
Interesting.
I discovered that there's a whole range of emotional palette of many different emotions. There's a whole lot of other stuff, but it was incredibly disorienting. And oftentimes the only emotion when you know when you are that desperate to succeed without failing is anger or frustration.
Frustration, yes. Anger, no.
And then
I have an inability to be angry. I never have been able to be angry.
And that is probably a saving grace in that extreme time.
Could be. It could be.
So where did you end up going to college? Or did you?
I did. I hated my college. I loved my graduate school. I hated my college. And as embarrassing as it is, when I was a kid, I was a big fan of Fu Manchu novels. And Fu Manchu at one point said, I will never mention the name of a something or other. And I decided I would never mention the name of my undergraduate college. And I never have.
Okay.
And I won't.
No.
I went to a great graduate school, though.
And what was the difference? What made the one almost mythic in its lack of being able to carry it forward, and the other one mythic in your need to carry it forward?
Well, what's the old saying that nature, that the children are nature's revenge? My youngest son is now very happily ensconced at Google and doing remarkably well, but he doesn't even have a high school degree because he could never work for anyone or study under anyone unless he thought that person was as bright as he was. And frankly, he's really bright. He's brighter than I am. And so he was never able to until he got to Google. Fortunately, they gave him a chance there. And at Google, he's found people that are as smart as he is, and so he's happy. So where does this start?
What was different about graduate school than undergraduate?
I found really, really super people there. And it was, in some ways, to me, a Greek tragedy. The professors there, the people there, were working on the absolute most difficult problems there were. And almost by definition, they were bound to fail.
Sure.
And yet it was the fight. It was the honor and the wonderfulness of the fight.
That comes from really watching a failure.
Well, I don't want to even say failure, although
you're using it in a technical sense that it didn't achieve the specific intended.
In Scandinavian mythology, the idea is that chaos will win. But the fight against it is what is important. You fight against chaos even though you know it's going to win. And I felt that with my professors at graduate school. They were fighting. They were trying to understand the universe at the deepest level. Some of them made quite a name for themselves. But in general, that's too difficult a job.
Right. And there's, in theory, in people who study learning, most of us only learn from our failures, and the failures need to be big enough that we recognize them as failures, and they need to be not so big that they shut us down with shame and humiliation in terms of others' response or our response to them. So there's this window in which we can learn, and things that we do successfully, we really learn little or nothing from because we already on some sense knew, so we don't have the curiosity or the inequality of engagement.
Well, that's interesting. Deep theoretical physics, your failure is more common than success.
Right.
So I think we learn a lot.
That's why we have come to similar insights by very different paths.
Interesting.
Part of what I'm backing into here.
Very interesting.
What should we play next musically?
Well, how about the Little March of the Fruit Flies? That has very interesting story behind it. Why don't we play it first, and I'll tell you what it is.
Okay.
It's only about a minute long. Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And that was the March of the Fruit Flies.
Little March of the Fruit Flies. It was a result of one of these. I thought it was a good idea at the time. And that was that I thought to take the... I wrote a computer program that would take chromosomes and turn them into music.
Uh-huh.
And it's not quite as crazy as it sounds, because the way codons, the three sets of bases that define an amino acid,
right.
There are about 20 amino acids, and there are 64 possible codons. So these codons are multiple codons refer to the same amino acid.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did was I took the most numerous codons to a particular acid and said, that's the fundamental note. And then the next one I did is the dominant, the fifth, and then the fourth, and then the octave. And so there was a natural progression. And so I did some other algorithm for changes of note duration. Mm-hmm. And I ran it into the output of it into a music synthesizer, which I also wrote, by the way. And so what you just heard was untouched by human hands. It was, I did not touch it at all. I took the beginning of the first chromosome of the fruit fly, converted it, sent it to my synthesizer, mm-hmm. and listened to the output, and frankly was amazed. I went, wow, this almost sounds like music.
Wow.
So that's the story of that.
That is a beautiful piece. And what in your life at that time, what was that project for you?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. Again, it was one of these, sounds like a good idea at the time.
Yeah.
One of my projects that, life is too short. I really need a lot more time. I need to clone myself or something. One of the things I wanted to
then
do.
Then you'd be greedy, you know.
I know, it's terrible. One of the things I've wanted to do for a long, long time was to create full orchestral sounds with arbitrarily fine accuracy, symbolically, mathematically, mm-hmm. in a computer.
Right.
So that rather than it being a synthesizer, which is something you play,
mm-hmm.
it would be something that would recreate from a score the full orchestral tone. The most complicated code I've ever written in my life, and it's never been finished, but large portions of it have.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd still like to go and finish it. I guess in my secret heart of hearts, I'd like to also be a composer.
Right.
And it's a problem with beginning composers. How do you find an orchestra to play your pieces?
Absolutely.
So I thought, well, I'll create the orchestra.
Right. Wow.
My editor at Analog Magazine, a fellow physicist, incidentally, also a fellow language buff, is also a trumpeter in a semi-professional orchestra. So there's mm-hmm. a lot of confluence between physics and music.
Yeah, no, I can well imagine, and it conforms to what I have experienced knowing people. How has your life changed in ways you would not have predicted or even necessarily have chosen?
Well, I should say something first about my sleep schedule, strange as it sounds.
No, this is very important about you.
It is, actually. I'm a biphasic sleeper, which means that in a 24-hour period, I have two sleep periods rather than one. And if you do biphasic sleep properly, you're supposed to treat each of those days as separate days.
Mm-hmm.
So I have 2 days for every one of yours,
mm-hmm.
but it means I have to work faster during those days. It really does change one in a lot of ways, because I really do feel, I have no sense of time, and of course this doesn't help, that I can't tell whether something happened a week ago or earlier.
So this is biphasic that you manage externally. You have to keep track it.
Oh, yeah, so yeah. One has to go to bed at a precise time. I go to bed at midnight and get up at 4 in the morning, and then go back to bed at 9:30 and get up at 11:45. But each of those wake periods are treated as separate days.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And but that gives one a certain isolation from the rest of the world.
Sure.
If it weren't for the BBC and being able to listen to BBC News at 4 o'clock my time and 9 o'clock their time, which is a civilized time. I don't think I'd have any. So I know what's going on in London more than I know what's going on in Ithaca, for instance.
Right. And maybe this is too much detail, but how does this relate to the fact that prior to the incandescent light bulb, many people had two periods, distinct periods of sleep at night that was interrupted by a period of awakefulness and attentiveness?
It's interesting that you know that, because many people don't. During the medieval period, it was very common to get up in the middle of the night and pray or think or do whatever and then go back to bed. So some people now argue that the biphasic mode is actually the more natural mode for people. I don't have an opinion on that.
Right. Right. And the idea that we have used artificial light as a mm-hmm. way to mm-hmm. regulate our
yes.
patterns in ways that may or may not fit. But I mean, I realize I do have to shut the lights off if I really want to get to sleep.
And I have super bright lights so that when I get up at four in the morning, I can turn on bright lights and say, it's daytime.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what I'm... you knew from the age of 9 what you wanted to do.
More or less, yes.
More or less, in terms of the thrust. You figured out somewhere along the line that you were a biphasic sleeper and you had to mm-hmm. honor that. I'm wondering what your spouse or your kids or whatever did in that process, because I imagine that's kind of hard to get the family trained.
Well, that was after family period. Yeah. That was
later in life.
Relatively later, yeah.
So how did your life change when you realized and accepted that you were a biphasic sleeper?
In many ways, it didn't change at all, because my life is so internal.
Mm-hmm.
And so my internal life was pretty much constant. The external, I'm a curious person by nature, and when I go outside or whatever, everything seems strange and new and wonderful. It always has. And I guess it was, who was it? Was it C.S. Lewis that said that when you grow up, you shouldn't give up your childhood, you should just expand it? And my kids will say that in spades, that I haven't given up my childhood.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I still try to...
Do they say that with love, or do they say that with a certain amount of mixed judgment?
No, it's with love.
Yeah, because it could be said both ways.
My younger grandson, who's just turned, I can't believe it, he's just turned 16. When he was 8, he said, in the presence of my son, he said, he thinks of me as a helpful 12-year-old. And my son looked at me and said, yeah, that's about right. And I take that as a compliment, actually.
Yeah. So... And have you always accepted that as a compliment, or is that something you had to learn to grow into?
You know, it's in graduate school, one of my professors had the same reactions that I had to a lot of things. And I found out that he had a very similar childhood. It was a very deprived childhood and single parent and all. And he was enjoying his childhood when he could afford to. And I realized that's what I was doing too. I had such, I didn't have a childhood when I was a child, so I had it later.
Yeah.
And in many ways, I'm still having it. When I first got my doctorate and I had a really lucrative postdoc that, the first check came and it was more money than I had ever seen in my life. So what did I do? I was in New York at the time, and I thought, I'm going to do all these wonderful things that I wanted to do. So I looked for a guidebook to New York to do all these great things, and I couldn't find one. I finally found one. It was How to Enjoy New York with Children. And so I did all the things I wanted to do as a kid. I took riding lessons. I am embarrassed to say this, but I bought myself electric trains.
Uh-huh,
because
sure.
I always wanted
Absolutely.
Electric
yeah,
trains.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so... That defines me in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and that is a beautiful act of redemption, restoring to value something which didn't have the value at the time.
It could be.
Yeah, I mean, and making space for. I mean, mm-hmm. this is a language that it's not necessarily your language, but it's a language that is more than just narrowly institutionally religious.
I don't remember who it was. It might have been George Gamow, very famous mm-hmm. physicist. And he said, my friends in education get mad at me when I tell them this, but when a child is very young, he asks why, and makes a nuisance of himself. But society has found a wonderful solution to that, and it's called education. And he said the failures of that system are called scientists.
And what was his point?
His point is that we should keep the curiosity of childhood.
Yes.
We should keep it. It's important for us. And it's crucial for a scientist, of course.
Right, right. And this is where the practice, and this is a conversation Roald Hoffman and I have had on many occasions, the cultivation of curiosity in terms of mature spiritual practice and an openness to disconfirming experience is at the heart of mature religious faith way that it's the heart of the science.
What is
disconfirming?
Disconfirming. What does that mean?
When you're open to something you don't anticipate.
Oh, all right.
When it doesn't go the way you predicted it would, and you respond with curiosity.
You know, the religion is a strange thing. When I was a child, I was sort of set on my own to what to decide about religion.
Yeah.
And I didn't believe. I wasn't a believer.
Right.
But I thought there were so many people out there that believed that I better find someone to worship just because everyone else does. And so I thought, okay, who? And so I thought, I know, I will look for, I was an amateur Egyptologist at age 10, by the way. So I thought, I will find a god, a very nice god. And I chose the god Khnum. He's a very powerful god, but nobody knows about him.
Right.
And I thought I chose him because I'd have his undivided attention.
Uh-huh.
Which I thought was a very, very nice way of thinking about it.
It's a lovely 10-year-old approach to an eternal problem.
Yeah, well, I still think of myself as a disciple of Khnum, by the way.
It is an eternal problem.
Yes.
There are, where I come from is more on how do we engage what we don't know? How do we work with what we think we know? And how do we, you know, push things around? So it's not your usual, it's not like practicing religion by rule or science by theory or by the use of theory almost as a formula, which is the misapplication of science.
It is a misapplication.
And it's also the misapplication of religion.
Interesting.
In the same way.
Hmm.
And that's one of these divides as a country we need to get over. What brought me into such sharp relief, and I will use the name of my undergraduate college, which was Cornell, and I was a college scholar, and I did well.
Excellent.
But when I began to explore major questions, I had a handful of people who were wonderful, challenging, deep, and self-critical thinkers.
Hmm.
But when I went to Union Seminary in New York City,
went
from one of four or five at Cornell who were that challenging, deep thinking to one in two.
Really?
And
I bet I could tell you the two. Who was the famous person at Union?
Reinhold Niebuhr.
Reinhold Niebuhr, that's the person.
And
that's
Reinhold
him.
Niebuhr died 15 years before I arrived.
Oh, I didn't know. I have no sense of time.
But anyway, the most profound compliment I was paid as a student was that there were two things that I had in common with Reinhold Niebuhr. One is I put an addition to his prayer, which was the Serenity Prayer, and I added the notion one has to have a sense of time to sort out the proper response. The other one was that I ran up and down the stairs with work boots on, very much the way
nice.
He did, because he was constantly running about because he was a very, very busy guy, and I had a similar. But that was a very loving thing because I worked with the people who were his students.
Oh, really?
The man who inherited his mantle, Roger Shin.
A big mantle,
and Roger Shin, and one of his colleagues, Bob Handy. They were two of my instructors.
Oh, very nice.
Tom Driver was a student of Margaret Mead.
Oh, really?
So it was a very interesting place. And those were white guys, and they had a whole raft of African American faculty. James Forbes, Jim Cohn, Jim Washington, Cornel West, who
I know that name, of course.
I had him the first year after he finished his PhD in philosophy of religion.
Oh, really?
Anyway,
neat.
I'm rambling.
No, you're doing fine.
But what I discovered there was in that environment, they were sidelined from mainstream intellectual life in this culture.
So I understood.
And yet they were educated with wonderful, sharp analytics. Mm-hmm. And so to study with them when they were out of the spotlight meant that I feel like I got tools that I never could have gotten at a major research in a university. Yes. Because people are too much under the microscope to perform for the standards of the profession.
Yes.
And it detracts from the self-criticism that you need and the circumspection that you need to look profoundly at success, failure, what you're looking, you know, what the agenda is, what the task is. You said before they were trying, you know, they knew they were going to fail. They were up against chaos in the end. But the real essential part was the way in which you engaged the problem.
Interesting. As different as our areas of expertness, if you wish, are, I think we have a lot in common.
No, it's incredible. And I want to come back and ask a couple of more questions before we bring this to a close.
Oh, good.
But what should we play for our number three song? And we're going to have four total before we're done.
Three. I don't know why this appeals to me so much, but let's see. It would either be the Nimrod section of the Enigma Variations. I don't know why, but whenever I hear it, my eyes tear over. I don't know why.
Well,
it speaks to me in a funny way.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Carl Frederick. You said that this brings tears to your eyes, and I saw that happen as we began to play the piece.
And I have no idea why, by the way.
Well, and you have also said that you have very little fluency in emotion.
Yes.
And so what struck me listening to that piece was that is muscular longing.
There is longing in that piece.
There is intensely, and it's not just longing, passive longing. It is a muscular longing. There was an event in Ithaca.
Interesting.
An event in Ithaca a few years ago, prior to the initial invasion in Iraq in 2003, I think it was. And it was prayer for peace. And there was a person there who was practicing in this 24 hours a day for several days in a week, where we were meditating or praying on ideas of peace. And this person struck a pose, which is the pose for longing. And you embody in your gesture, and there's a way in which it's stretched out, and it looks out with such intense engagement of that which is not yet, that you feel it in every fiber of your being. And I said, not knowing what that pose is, I said, that looks like longing. And he said, that's the pose.
Interesting. In what discipline was
Hindu,
it?
Hinduism.
Hindu.
Okay. And it would be in yoga.
In yoga. Uh-huh.
And when I hear longing is something hard for us to label, because it reveals what is almost without words, mm-hmm. that is physical and emotional, that doesn't yet can't be rationalized.
Interesting.
And it reveals our vulnerability because we don't have it.
You know, you may have finally answered my question of why this does it to me. I think you're right. I think that could be.
I'm out on a limb here, and I often go out on a limb, but that's often, and sometimes I saw them off.
Yeah, well, that's good.
But we all fall.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah.
Yes.
A 9-year-old boy is the embodiment of rationalness and longing, which he cannot articulate often at that age, between 6 and 12, before the hormones or whatever take over, whatever things focus you in on stuff. And I just wonder if that touches a place in you, which is, you know, the 12-year-old that's going along with your kids.
It could be. It really could be. It really could be.
So the way we end the show, and we've got it about a little less than 10 minutes, is I ask people, what do you do to take care of yourself emotionally, physically, intellectually, throughout the day and daily, weekly, monthly? What do you do, and how do you know you need to do something to take care of yourself? Now, I realize that there are lots of things about your personality you're not particularly aware of. Time, you
No.
maintain a bimodal sleep pattern. All of these things are things, excuse me, which you seem to have adjusted to with good cheer, and I would hope that your family has too, although it can be hard. Mm-hmm. What do you
My
do
cat
to take,
has too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What do you do to take care of yourself? Well, how do you know you need to do it?
Well, physically, I run till exhaustion 6 days a week on an elliptical, absolutely heavy, half an hour. At 4 in the morning. That's the first thing I do when I get out of bed. And I do it very, very hard. I'm dripping buckets at the end of it.
Heart rate is up in the high hundreds.
Oh, yeah. Very much so.
Yeah.
And so after that, everything is easy for the day. Emotionally, I don't even understand the question entirely, really.
Well, okay. this is what I thought might come back from the question. So emotionally, it has to do with our ties to others and to so you can still yourself emotionally by exhausting yourself physically. That is often it both provides a good workout for the body, but it also tends to reduce the more impulsive emotions or contain them. But also having a person or something that you relate to where you can tell your story or tell your piece. Maybe it is in your story writing. Maybe it is in your
the
characters or in the way you engage your family as characters.
It's interesting. When I'm writing a long piece, after I did this last physics paper, which just relatively recently came out, I needed a vacation, so I decided I would write another novel. And when you write a novel, you live your characters, you live that life. You're in the environment, and in fact, when the novel is finished, it's not only me, it's a common feeling with writers. You feel a loss, a terrible loss, because you've suddenly been pulled out of that world. You're back in your world, and you've left the world and it's not, quote, the world you've created, because the novel takes off its own life.
Yes.
It has its own life.
Yes, yes.
It has its own evolution, and you're just almost in a way just transcribing. And so that's an important thing for me. That's my vacation. That's
right, right, right. And it also, but it also would be, it's a vacation, but it's also where you handle things that pass through you, that you have to, that you don't have to hold on to them. Where people get stuck emotionally is they hold on to feelings or attitudes or postures in relationships that they don't know how to let go of.
Hmm. Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. I have to think on that. I'm not sure. Tendency I had as a child, of course, was to hold on to things that were real, that were physical things,
right,
or thought things, and emotion mm-hmm. was not one of them.
Or it was embedded or imbued in the physical thing.
It probably was, in such a way that I couldn't even see it.
Right, 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 right. Mm-hmm. Right, and when did that ever change?
No, hate to admit it. No,
no, no, no. Yeah, and what you have done is you have made quite a life.
I mean, I love my kids and my grandkids, yes. But still, it's external in a lot of ways. Most of my life is still internal. Mm-hmm. I live alone, and frankly, I like it. I mean, I have a cat,
right,
but I like living alone. I like having the space for my own mind.
Right, right. And it is a... to give ourselves the gift... You could have described the damage that the experience that you had growing up, because in some ways you could describe it that way, but you squeezed out of it.
As did you.
Yes, as did I. But there are certain things that you can't do that other people may do.
I think that's
true. And learning how to accept that,
mm-hmm.
and how to warn people around you that that's the case, so they don't come into a relationship or a friendship or something mm-hmm. expecting mm-hmm. something that's not possible,
mm-hmm.
then it becomes a real rich life.
I think that's probably very astute, what you've just said. Yes.
I'm trying to live it.
As am I.
Yes, yes. So Carl, what should we listen to close the show today?
Well, strange as it sounds, I'm also a bagpiper. And so I have a very ancient piece of bagpipe music. Most people know the marches and the reels. But there's a classical tradition in bagpiping called pibroch.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the beginning, the ground. Pibroch is essentially a theme and variations. And the ground, called the urlar, is the theme. And then there are variations on it.
It's the melody that then gets variations on.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. Sometimes there are two or possibly even three themes. But in the classical works, it's generally one theme. And then, or in the old classical works, mm-hmm. and then variations on them. And so this is a theme from something called the Park Pibroch No. 2.
We will play that. Carl, it has been wonderful to get to know you.
It's been a great pleasure being here. Thank you, Eric.